This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. It's an opportunity for you to pose your questions. Please send them to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we'll do our best to answer your questions on the air during one of these podcasts. With us today, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian, and she possesses a master's degree in the field of nutrition. We work together on a daily basis, seeing patients at the Hoffman Center in New York. And Layla also has her own individual practice, sometimes working with patients who have and maintain contact with their own doctors and don't need to see me. So check out drhoffman.com for how you can become a patient, either of the Hoffman Center or of Layla. So what's her next question, Layla?
Okay, we've got an email from Niall. Mm-hmm. I hope you add herbicides, pesticides, preservatives, and emulsifiers to the list of potential food additives that likely add to the unbalance of intestinal flora in all people.
Yep.
Obviously most pronounced in people with inflammatory bowel disease.
Mm-hmm.
Eating organic is not enough because many organic products still contain the listed contaminants. Think of what a preservative does to your intestinal flora if such a small amount will kill off everything in a large quantity of food.
Is this a question?
What's it doing to our intestines?
This is a question?
It's a question.
Okay.
It's a comment and a question. It's a little bit of a rant and a question.
Right. Okay, so let us... I'm going to start with a little bit of a Greek history. During the Hellenic period, which is roughly, I don't know, 250 BC, around there, after the conquest of Asia by Alexander, they set up these Hellenic kingdoms that variously warred and intrigued against each other. And there was a famous king. I'm actually going to get to a point here eventually. His name Mithridates, and Mithridates was a very interesting guy because he realized that, you know, one of the favorite ways, means of assassination in those days was via poisoning. And there were literally, historically, scores of people who were vying for the successorship of Alexander, who was the supreme leader, and his empire broke up, and then there were warring factions. Literally scores of potential heirs to Alexander and would-be kings and rulers were poisoned, they had developed it to a fine art. You know, you could all kinds of different ways to off people in ways what they wouldn't detect. So Mithridates had a theory that if every day he took a little poison, he actually became a connoisseur of poisons. And so whenever a new poison was discovered, he said, "Great, let me dilute it and let me try it, and thereby I'm going to build up a resistance to it." And ultimately, he survived many poisoning attempts, but I think he succumbed to a poisoning. It didn't really work out. But, this is a principle that, a tiny amount of some things that are challenging or poisonous are not always, fatal or pernicious, but that they sometimes challenge the body to respond better. And in fact, in the wake of Mithridates, throughout the common era, you know, even after the birth of Christ, centuries later, and in the Dark Ages and Middle Ages, they put together various elixirs called Mithridates formula to ward off all manner of illness. And they were basically toxins And the idea was that if you give small enough doses of toxins, that the toxins will heal you. Now, I'm not saying that we should deliberately ingest toxic stuff. I'm just saying this by way of applying a little bit of correction to a thought process whereby even tiny or infinitesimal amounts of bad things get into our systems, and and we're doomed. You know, it's not good, and we want to minimize that exposure. But lest we obsess too much about every morsel of food, every potential chemical exposure, we could keep in mind the historical precedent of Mithridates. Okay? So that being said, you know, let's talk about, you know, what these chemicals do. They actually do act as, you know, when you consume pesticides, they kill pests, but they also kill bacteria in our intestinal tract. And that's one of the problems with GMO foods. They allow weeds to be sprayed with a lot of glyphosate, which is said to be harmless to mammals. So if we ingest it, if our pets ingest it, not a problem. We can eat the foods that have been sprayed with glyphosate, which is Roundup. But when our bacteria internally are exposed to it, it may alter our microbiome. And the same thing with things like aspartame, NutraSweet. The same thing with a lot of the emulsifiers that are used. Emulsifiers are used to give food a little mouth feel, you know, and you know, even health foods. And then there's all the, you know, chemical soup that, you know, preservatives and so on and so on that might alter or suppress the microbiome. There's antibiotic residues in certain foods, and, you know, the antibiotics might suppress the growth of certain bacteria. So.
Well, here's the thing. What I would tell Niall is that he says that even organic products still contain the listed contaminants. Yes, but a fraction or so, or we should like to think, or even as an undergrad when I actually had to do a paper on this, the benefits of organic and are they contaminated, they could be contaminated up to 25% or so. But it's still the best case scenario. The cleaner that we can eat, the better off we're going to be, but the more that we can also re-inoculate our gut with beneficial bacteria by eating prebiotic foods, taking prebiotic and probiotic supplements, all of that, probiotic foods as well, this is the best thing that we could do in this environment.
Right. So there's actually a word for what I was referring to earlier, the Mithridates phenomenon. The word is hormesis. It's spelled H-O-R-M-E-S-I-S. And if you Google it, you can read this definition. Hormesis is a biological phenomenon whereby a beneficial effect, i.e. improved health, stress tolerance, growth, or longevity, results from exposure to low doses of an agent that is otherwise toxic or lethal when given at higher doses. Okay? So we sometimes refer to this as eustress or good stress, positive stress, stress that gets us, is like boot camp stress. But we know that that may occur with certain things.
Yeah. That it's meant to be provocative and not overstressed or burden. More than anything.
So another way of saying it, quite simply, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. However, I would not necessarily endorse that as a lifestyle.
Right. Niall, thank you for your question and rant.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we've got an email from Terry. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My recent blood work came back, and although I take 4,000 IU of vitamin D a day, I remain at a level of 32. My question is this. I am no sun worshipper, but since it is summer and I'm getting more sun exposure than obviously in the winter, I walk, I garden, should I continue to take the 4,000 IU of D because of my lower number? Or do you think because of the increase of sun exposure, I should cut back to around 2,000? I've been taking 4,000 for well over 6 months now, and the number has not changed.
Well, you have to experiment because there's no question that sun contributes to your level of vitamin D. There's actually a feedback mechanism whereby when your vitamin D is pretty high, the sun does less, but it should not kick in at 32.
That's true.
The level of 32 is okay, but not optimal. We might want to see it 40. And there's a lot of reasons why people, you know, who consume vitamin D don't have a good vitamin D response. Some people have malabsorption. They may be taking an acid blocker or other reasons they don't absorb nutrients very well. Other people...
Liver and kidney function.
Sure,
yeah. Maybe compromised.
Yep.
Where the vitamin D is actually turned into, synthesized into active hormone.
Yep. There's also, there are what are called polymorphisms for vitamin D receptors. That shouldn't affect so much the level in your bloodstream, but it affects the end organ response to vitamin D. There's also racial disparities in vitamin D. It's now been found that people of more pure African background who are very dark-skinned, and I won't say African-American because African-American is a whole spectrum of some people having a lot of Caucasian influence, that there's a little bit of a different pattern of the way that vitamin D is carried by protein in the blood. And if you're a dark-skinned African-American and your vitamin D is 32, that may be the equivalent of a 45 for a light-skinned, red-headed Caucasian. So there's some speculation about that, although that hasn't quite been worked out. Also the fact that in conditions where the body's really challenged by inflammation or illness, infection, autoimmunity, that the requirement for vitamin D seems to go up.
Yes.
So,
it's the antibiotic vitamin.
Yeah. And it's almost as if it gets consumed at quenching inflammation or fighting infection.
And our levels do tend to go down. I mean, the vitamin D present in our body tends to get used up in about 3 weeks or so, for the most part. So it would take. I also want to mention, we don't know how old Terry is, and if you're counting on the sun to give you your vitamin D, first of all, you have to be out at the right time of day, which is around lunchtime. The second thing is, if you're over the age of 60, 65 or so, you're not going to have enough 7-dehydrocholesterol under your skin to mingle with the UVB rays and create vitamin D.
Yes.
So,
old skin is not as efficient.
Keep taking, keep taking. And there was a study, it was an older study done on men in Nebraska, where over the course of the winter at least, they needed to take an average of 7,000 IU a day to maintain adequate levels of vitamin D.
Wow.
So it could be 4,000 isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
Terry, thank you very much for your question. Keep taking your vitamin D. Make sure that you're taking vitamin D3 and not D2.
Yep, because that's less bioavailable.
Right. And it actually steals from D3, doesn't it? Or it impairs our vitamin D more than anything, taking D2. I don't know why it's still prescribed by so many doctors, but I'm seeing less and less of it.
Yeah, it seems that the vitamin D, when doctors prescribe it, is vitamin D2, and when you buy in a health food store, it's more likely to be vitamin D3. You know that vitamin D2 is what's called ergocalciferol, and it's made from mushrooms that are irradiated. So when you put a mushroom under a sun lamp, and you can synthesize vitamin D, it makes the mushroom turn brown. They actually get a tan, and that is associated with vitamin D synthesis, just as in people when they get a tan. The cholecalciferol is derived from lanolin, which you get when you shear a sheep. You get sort of a rich, oily substance that's used for skin creams and hair creams. And it's basically helps to lubricate the coats of the sheep so that they act as a raincoat. You know, Irish sweaters that are rich in lanolin actually protect the Irish from the, you know, rain. You know, you'd say, that's ridiculous. Yes. Don't wear a sweater
like a
into
barrier.
The,
yeah.
Don't wear a sweater into the rain. Well, the sheep don't have, you know, all they have is their, is their wool. But when it's lanolin rich, it actually, the water beads up on it and, they don't become soaked to the skin. They actually, sort of like a raincoat protected barrier. But anyway.
Proof.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's like a sealant. We have time for another question, so.
Okay. We've got a question from Paul, and actually I wrote about this recently in the newsletter. Are there some supplements that should not be taken together? I seem to recall reading that supplements containing iron and vitamin C should not be taken together. I don't recall why. Well, the reason is if you already have a high iron level and there's iron in your food or in your supplement and you take vitamin C along with it or eat foods containing vitamin C, like strawberries, oranges, red peppers, then that can actually enhance the absorption of iron. So unless you have anemia, it's probably best not to take any supplement containing iron with additional vitamin C, in
right.
my estimation.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be, you know, there could be a danger because overaccumulation of iron in the body can become toxic to the heart. It may feed infection. And, you know, nobody should really be taking an iron supplement unless they've been diagnosed with iron deficiency anemia or have quite low storage levels, ferritin levels. And that's why I like Foundation Formula.
Mm-hmm.
There is no iron there. A multi without iron would be the ideal way to go.
What do you think of the alleged incompatibility of calcium and magnesium? It used to be, remember when we just got started in nutrition? They used to say absolutely separate your calcium from your magnesium.
No. Strontium needs to be separated from those. You know, thyroid medication needs to be separated from all of those. But calcium and magnesium, if you don't take, first of all, I don't think it really matters whether they're taken together or not, but anybody taking a calcium supplement alone is actually in danger of developing kidney stones without the magnesium to help keep that from crystallizing and becoming stones.
Right.
So that, yeah. No, calcium. And the other thing is, calcium can cause constipation. It will turn the stool into concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Magnesium helps to counteract that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I think that's about as many questions as we want to fit in today. I know we have a few left over. A reminder that listeners can email their questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And these podcasts are free. I hope you enjoy them. We have reached a milestone. We now have 2.5 million downloads since the inception
of
Intelligent Medicine. And we're now at the rate of about 130,000 downloads per month, so people are taking advantage of the free information. And we want to assure you a continued flow of free information. One of the ways that you can help to indirectly subsidize this podcast and also assure you health benefits is to patronize our Hoffman Center store, which you can find at drhoffman.com. You can find it at hoffmancenter.com. There you'll find supplements of excellence that we curate specially for our patients, and we make them available to the general public. So you, too, can partake of the finest quality supplements at reasonable prices and also support an enterprise that I'm sure you all believe in. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Layla, for being with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.